Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we learn how local entrepreneurs and programmers are cashing in on Bitcoin. Plus, we talk politics with Bill McEwen of GV Wire, and we learn about a little-known company in the Sierra that dominates California's logging industry. Plus, an interview with famed musician and record producer Herb Alpert as he gets ready to appear in Bakersfield for a concert with his wife Lonnie Hall. All that coming up later in our show. We begin, though, with a look ahead towards the election. On June 5th, Kern voters will put their voices where their ballots are and either decide to re-elect incumbent Sheriff Donnie Youngblood for a fourth term or award the duty to Justin Fleeman, a senior chief deputy for the sheriff's office. FM 89's Christina Lopez reports.
We want to go ahead and get right into it. We're going to do things a little bit differently than some of the questions. So,
last week, a group of about 70 people gathered at Bakersfield College for the Meet Your Candidates public forum. The two-hour event was sponsored by a coalition of nonprofits, including Faith in the Valley, Building Healthy Communities, and the ACLU, Southern California. It focused on topics like police accountability, department budgets, immigration, and gun violence. Those on stage included both candidates for District Attorney Scott Spielman and Cynthia Zimmer, as well as Sheriff's candidate Chief Deputy Justin Fleeman.
I want to have an open door policy so anybody in the immigrant community can come and talk to me, discuss issues that are affecting them.
One candidate who wasn't there, current Sheriff Donnie Youngblood. His absence represented with an empty chair on stage.
The candidates that you see before you are the ones that accepted. Mr. Youngblood unfortunately declined our offer, and we followed up with his office on multiple different occasions.
The move just weeks before a hotly contested election left many in the crowd talking. Laurel Shropshire has been a Kern resident for over three decades and says she understands Sheriff Youngblood's absence from the event.
Sometimes I guess that just happens. It doesn't bother me because I understand that Donnie Youngblood is our acting sheriff. I mean, he can't be everywhere at all times. He does still have a job to do.
But Rosa Lopez, who helped organize the event, says the sheriff's absence sent a different message to the largely Latino East Side community.
By not being here, not being present, really just sends a message to the community of how much he values or validates their concerns and their opinion. And so, again, being that this forum was directed to the community in the East Side and having your sheriff absent, that speaks volumes.
Lopez is with the ACLU Southern California's Kern office. She says holding the forum here was an intentional move to bring the candidates to a part of the community that often gets overlooked.
It was very strategic with the idea of really taking a space like this into the east side of the community. In a neutral space, we are not endorsing any candidates, but what we want to do is provide this space for community to learn and speak about the issues that concern you and your family.
While his opponent was a no-show, Fleeman took the opportunity to explain why he attended the forum.
At the end of the day, this county deserves to be serviced properly. They need to have an elected official that'll show up to meetings like this, engage the public, and actually work for them.
Last week's public forum was not the only request Youngblood has declined during this election. He's also turned down repeated requests over the last month and a half to comment to Valley Public Radio regarding the race. Despite his reclusive nature from the campaign trail in these final days of the election, Sheriff Youngblood is no stranger to Kern's voters. Having served for the past 12 years as the region's sheriff, Youngblood is relying on his staunch stance as a defender of the Second Amendment and a proponent for anti-sanctuary states. Meantime, his opponent, Justin Fleeman, is a name that's less familiar outside of the Kern County Sheriff's Office. Fleeman has worked as a senior chief deputy with KCSO. His career with the department has spanned nearly 20 years. Although Fleeman identifies as a Republican, he describes the role of sheriff as one of nonpartisan politics. He's campaigning on leadership, morale within the department, and public safety.
In law enforcement, we don't go ask people, what is your party preference before we provide service? We're going to provide service to everybody in this community, and that includes whether you're here legally or illegally. We're going to support and enforce the laws that are on the books and make people feel like they're welcomed in Kern County.
The sheriff's race has had its share of national controversy. In April, a 12-year-old video surfaced on Facebook posted by the Kern County Detention Officers Association. The video excerpt depicts then-sheriff candidate Youngblood speaking candidly on tape about the advantages surrounding deputies when they shoot to kill rather than shoot and injure a suspect.
You know what happens when a guy makes a bad shooting on somebody and kills them? $3 million, the family goes away after a long back and forth and back and forth. Which way do you think is better financially? To cripple them or kill them? For the county.
Sure.
Absolutely. Because if you cripple them, you got to take care of them for life. And that cost goes way up.
Youngblood's off-the-cuff comments rippled through the county and eventually caught the attention of national media, including CNN. The sheriff has since gone on record to address those remarks, explaining his regrets over his choice of wording. Other controversies leading into the race, the ongoing investigation of policies and practices within the KCSO and Bakersfield Police Department over cases involving use of force. With police brutality one of the key issues on voters' minds this primary election, the State Attorney General's office continues its examination into Kern's law enforcement agencies. The race has even prompted debate among rank-and-file department employees. In March, the Kern Law Enforcement Association announced its endorsement for Chief Deputy Fleeman, who received 52% of the votes cast from over 200 members. But as of last week, the association held another vote and rescinded its support of Fleeman, stating its disapproval of Fleeman's campaign. The association has since elected not to endorse any candidate at this time. Fleeman says he will continue to campaign in the final weeks and days leading up to the June 5th election. As for Youngblood, voters can expect to see his name on the ballot. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Christina Lopez in Bakersfield.
And to continue our discussion into the upcoming June election, we have with us Bill McEwen of GV Wire. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Looking at state politics, the gubernatorial race is one of the most interesting out there. Of course, Gavin Newsom, the Democratic frontrunner, had been laying low, not necessarily appearing in debates, cementing his leadership status. Two Republicans in the contest, and then a field of Democrats. One of them, though, got a rather unexpected endorsement. Tell me about this prominent Republican lining up behind Antonio Villaraigosa and why it's significant.
So it happened Friday, and former Fresno Mayor Alan Autry came out and endorsed Villaraigosa for governor. And Alan's thinking is similar to some Republicans in the state in that he believes that a Republican does not have a chance to win the governorship, just because of registration numbers, fundraising advantage by the Democrats in this state, big union backing for Gavin Newsom. And so the calculus is a Democrat's going to win. Who is the Democrat that best reflects my own values? Who will be the more conservative leader? To put a label on it, you could say Villaraigosa is a blue dog Democrat, a conservative Democrat. So that's the thinking. And Villaraigosa has received millions upon millions of dollars, which is why you're seeing all these ads on TV boosting his candidacy, money spent either by his own campaign or by independent groups in support of him. And what has happened is the same day that Autry backs Villaraigosa, he gets a little bit of attraction, some headlines around the state for that backing. On that same day, President Trump tweets that he's backing John Cox, the Republican, for governor. And as you know, Joe, John Cox in the polls leads Villaraigosa. And I think this Trump endorsement is going to boost his stock even more. And I think it's going to be very hard for Villaraigosa, despite all the money that he's raised, to be able to finish in that second spot in the jungle primary, as they call it.
A year ago, all the talk was Newsom, Villaraigosa, and then the rest of the field behind, quite a bit behind in discussion, especially in this new top two primary environment. Is it a surprise that Villaraigosa is not performing better? And is it a surprise that John Cox is performing as well as he is in a state that is increasingly, Republicans are increasingly seeing their voting registration numbers decline?
Well, Republicans are loyal to the party. They're going to want to pick a candidate. And thus far, they've made it fairly clear that they prefer Cox over Travis Allen. And I think part of that, I'm not so sure it's about personality or issues. John Cox is a wealthy San Diego businessman, and he's been able to self-fund his campaign and get his message out there. And he's constantly been on the road. You know, he goes to every city. You know, he just shows up and introduces himself to people. Travis Allen's campaign has been really hampered by the lack of funding, and he's been unable to get big donors to come in and support his candidacy. And with this Trump endorsement, I see Travis Allen losing some support, and all of that support going to John Cox.
Speaking of being on the road, Villaraigosa has been on the road and here in the Valley a lot. Is that a winning strategy for him? Seemingly looking at the demographic numbers, he would play very well in Southern California, the large Latino Democratic base there. Seems like that would be his stronghold, but he's spent a lot of time in Central California. Surprise, or is that just what it takes to get a few percentage points from centrist voters?
So that was all part of Villaraigosa's calculation, and the thinking is that Villaraigosa, as the former mayor of Los Angeles, will do very well in Southern California and also with Latino voters. Gavin Newsom, the expectation is he's going to do very well with Northern California and Bay Area Democrats. Therefore, those two sides kind of cancel each other out, and Villaraigosa would swamp Newsom in the Valley. And the thinking was, you have a lot of Republicans in the Valley. Villaraigosa is going to appeal to them as the lesser of two evils, if you will. And he'll be able to pick up strong Democratic and Latino support in the Valley. So this was definitely their game plan. Thus far, doesn't look like it's working, according to the polls.
Of course, turnout is key in any election, but especially in a midterm primary. This is not known for one of those races that's known for the sexy turnout numbers. What are you hearing from people on that as far as June?
So what I'm looking at is if, you know, you're a Democrat and you watch MSNBC, you know, you're told about this blue wave and all this activism, and I believe it's going on. But I don't know that it's going to go on for the California primary. And when you look at the PPIC polling consistently showing that people say they don't know or they know very little about Villaraigosa or Newsom, it doesn't seem like the people are really engaged. Now, there's going to be a flood of television advertising. It's already begun. Maybe people will start paying attention. In California, traditionally, people don't start paying attention until about a week to go. We'll see if that happens this time.
Yeah, and of course, California is going to be a key, or at least is said to be key, for Democrats in their hope to retake the House. The House seats that are up here in California that are competitive, a few of them in our area, although in those cases, anything to really watch for there, Valadao, Denham, Devin Nunes, do they have anything to worry about in the numbers that will come out in June?
So just before we go there, the reason that President Trump endorsed Cox and came out and got involved in this is the goal is to energize California Republicans, give them a reason to go to the polls, and by doing so, help the House GOP candidates in California. So a fairly shrewd strategy. I don't know that President Trump came up with it. More likely, Kevin McCarthy engineered that strategy. But
my man, Kevin.
Yeah, so certainly it was a big surprise last Friday. Here in the Valley, You know, you can look at the Cook Political Report. That shows that Jeff Denham's in a toss-up. Denham's been there before and emerged victorious. I think that's what's motivating Denham and David Valadao on this immigration issue, Joe. We haven't talked about it, but they have bolded against GOP party leadership. They're bucking Kevin McCarthy. They're bucking Paul Ryan, and they're trying to force a vote on four immigration bills. It's called the Queen of the Hill tactic, and basically the way it works, if a Republican can get 24 other Republicans to sign on to a bill and then get enough Democratic support to have more than one, a majority, they're allowed to bring these to a vote. They don't have the 25 Republicans yet. But they've been getting, they're pretty close.
Very interesting, and we will look forward to seeing that on Election Day and how it all turns out. Turning to Alan Autry, he was also front and center after being kind of on the behind the curtains for quite a while.
He was Do you get the feeling he might be thinking about running for office again?
Wondering about that. He was front and center when the Temperance Flat funding announcement or lack of funding came out. This was from the California Water Commission spending the money that California voters approved over 4 years ago for the water bond. Temperance Flat did not receive the type of funding that backers had hoped. Looking at that in retrospect, you had two big reservoir projects, Sites Reservoir and Temperance Flat, looking for money. Sites got a good chunk, not enough to build the reservoir itself, but at least a good start. Temperance Flat came way short. Were both of these going to be winners, or was one destined to be coming up short regardless?
So I don't know that they were destined to be losers, because between the two of them, if you split it down the middle and gave each $1.3 billion, throw in federal funding, throw in what the people that would benefit from the project would be required to pay, you can get it built. So what happened is two Bay Area reservoirs being expanded, and they swallowed up, what, about $900 million between the two of them. So that left Sites pitted against Temperance Flat. And Sites, one, has far more political support, bipartisan political support, strong push from the Bay Area. It even has the support of environmental groups. You know, it's an off-river reservoir. Environmentalists like that. And Temperance Flat, so they're in that fight against Sites, and they came out second best.
Going back to Autry, do you think he has his sights on a particular office?
So I think that Congress would appeal to him.
Interesting. Well, we'll watch.
But Congress appeals to a lot of people around here, and, you know, we have many well-known names who are always doing that calculation, and one of the biggest questions that's always asked of me is, when will Jim Costa retire? And I don't have any insight into that.
Is Alan almost too big of a personality to be one of several hundred members of the House?
I don't think so. One, he'd go there and he'd try to make a splash right away. And then party leadership. And right now, I think he's registered as no party preference or some kind of independent. I don't know that you can run as an independent and get to Congress. A Bernie Sanders case is very rare. A Joe Lieberman case is very rare.
Although Autry still does have the name ID and the following here in the Fresno area. Before we go really quick, District 7 Fresno City Council, what should we watch for there? Is that really the race to watch here?
So what's interesting to me is, and Joe, I know you hate this, you know, this name calling, this back and forth, this kind of gutter politics between the Islas camp and the Whalen camp. But they're consuming all the oxygen in this race. And Nelson Esparza, he's kind of the moderate Democrat in this. You know, he's backed by the Perea machine or the Perea political organization. And when is anybody talking about Nelson Esparza right now? But the names in the headlines are Whalen and Islas. And Islas actually used this controversy about her last name to fundraise. So while she's saying, you know, Brian Whelan needs to apologize to me. I don't think so. I think she wants to keep the controversy going.
That's a familiar tactic that many politicians use. Bill McEwen, GV Wire, thanks so much for joining us as we look forward to the upcoming election.
Thanks for having me on today, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. A lot of the news about Bitcoin recently has been all about ups and downs. The Bitcoin bubble, you may recall that from late last year. While the total number of people with Bitcoin is just a fraction of the world's population, some of them happen to live right here in the Valley. FM89's Laura Tsutsui reports that some of those users aren't necessarily hoping to strike it rich, but instead are trying to understand how cryptocurrency could be a part of our lives in years to come.
Anthony Yang is a researcher and content developer in downtown Fresno.
Outside of work, like this weekend, my plan is to come in and work and go on Reddit, read articles.
He's the kind of person who listens to YouTube videos at twice the normal speed so he can learn a lot in a short amount of time. Something he's decided to start learning about in the last year is Bitcoin.
I probably will check it once or twice a week. That's honestly about it. And if I do check, it would be to check where Bitcoin's at. And then once in a while, I'll Google and see what's, if there are any updates or huge changes in the cryptocurrency news.
Yang isn't into Bitcoin to get rich. He's exploring it because he wants to understand how this might affect his life in the coming years. He's not the only one in Fresno trying to figure it out.
Nice to meet you, I'm Kurt. Everyone's familiar here. I'm like, there's the new face.
Once a month, in the basement of Bitwise South Stadium, a group of Bitcoin enthusiasts meet to talk about the latest cryptocurrency news. It's hard to know how many Bitcoin users actually live in Fresno, but the group boasts 300 members, and about 15 showed up. Kurt Arison started the group over a year ago.
It's so much going on. You could spend a day and you could spend the next year researching this stuff and still be lost in it all. Every single day there's new updates, there's new things happening, and you think, oh, I figured this all out. And then you wake up one day and you're like, I don't understand any of this. And you like start from scratch.
Arison says that the conversations end up getting philosophical very fast.
You really start to question, like, what is value and what is my bank providing for me?
He says that Bitcoin users challenge traditional financial institutions because Bitcoin isn't owned or managed by any one person or government. Cryptocurrencies are decentralized money, tracked on a meticulously kept ledger online. So someone could exchange their dollars for Bitcoin, watch the price fluctuate, and if the price is up, maybe end up with more dollars than they started with. And since it's decentralized, someone can transfer money to someone else without the oversight of a bank or expensive wire transfer fees. Some are hoping that the ledger could be used to not only track money, but also data. Despite the fact that Bitcoin is a currency, the group hardly discussed using it to buy anything. Susan Athey is a professor at the Stanford Business School.
So I've done some research about how people were using these cryptocurrencies. And, you know, early on, mostly it's store of value or an investment. So people are buying them and holding them and then selling them. That's by far the biggest thing people do.
She expects even more uses for Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies will develop over the years, but not as a substitute for the dollars used every day.
So the cryptocurrency is really a technology it's like a pipe or a way to transfer value. It's also a way to keep track of things, keep track of information. So it's not really a direct consumer product.
While Athey sees a lot of potential, she warns against getting into cryptocurrency as a way to make money. She says that the value changes too much for people to make decisions that aren't risky, and there are no guarantees the market will move in your favor. Justin Hicks is an economics professor at UC Merced. He says it's possible that cryptocurrencies will be used as everyday money once the fluctuation in value slows down.
We've been moving away from physical currency for a long time. You know, it's the next evolution in how we define and what we as a society trust as money. Now, how that evolves, you know, 10 years, 15 years, how will it be regulated? That's a very difficult question to answer. But I do absolutely believe that we will be in a fully digital economy.
Like Athey, Hicks says that kind of use isn't likely to happen anytime soon.
At this point, the demand for the cryptocurrencies is based on an expectation of what the demand might become. And that is why it is so volatile.
For someone who doesn't understand programming or economics, figuring out Bitcoin can be intimidating. A company called CoinMe just installed its second Bitcoin ATM in Fresno with the intention of making the process of getting Bitcoin much simpler. Dom Garrett is with the company. He says having a physical ATM and customer service support will hopefully ease people who are on the fence about it to try it out.
You know, there's a lot of people that want to figure out how to get into it, but you know, there's lack of information or misinformation. People don't know how to do it, or you know, people are still kind of scared to just throw their bank account information onto a website that they've never heard of before and then not actually get anything physical or tangible, you know, just have internet money that's out there.
Garrett says he thinks that Bitcoin will end up being as revolutionary as the internet. And Anthony Yang agrees.
I think for me, what kept me into it was the idea that, hey, this is a technology that can empower people. And that's why I believe in it, yeah.
For the time being, Bitcoin is still a very speculative technology, but Yang doesn't mind waiting to see what happens. He's invested for the long haul. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Red Emerson is not a household name in California, but he's one of the most powerful forces in the Sierra. With his company, Sierra Pacific Industries, he's built a billion-dollar logging empire that has grown even more successful thanks to being aggressive in the field of logging trees in the wake of recent wildfires, like the Rim Fire near Yosemite National Park. A new profile in Forbes explores how Emerson built his empire and why he's also a controversial figure among some. Journalist Chloe Sorvino joins us now to tell us more. Chloe, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there are a number of big logging companies in the West. How does Sierra Pacific compare to its rivals?
Yeah, so it is the biggest privately owned logging company in California, and they really have been around for decades, and they've dug in where a lot of other major competitors have left. So where the Georgia Pacifics of the world were getting out of California because it was too hard to do logging there because of regulations or environmentalists, for example, the Emerson family decided to stay with it, and they acquired a lot of land and expanded their sawmills as their bigger competitors were leaving. And that's really how they originally started growing.
How were they able to do that?
Well, you know, Red Emerson first made a name for himself just by having a really great knack for being able to get the most out of any log. So he was pretty obsessive about it, and that's where the company was originally able to make higher margins than some of their competitors and to then be able to compete with purchasing logs from national forests, bidding higher than their competitors, and then also bidding for some of these, you know, acquisitions as they came up, as the bigger companies were trying to leave.
I understand some of those regulations the state has also have helped the company itself.
Yes, definitely. In particular, there's a federal regulation where, you know, that's been around since the 1990s that states that if your timber company ever exports logs to somewhere outside of America, they can't bid on any logs from national forests. So that's where, you know, for example, a Weyerhaeuser that's very big in Washington state, you know, can't bid on some of these California contracts.
Tell us a little more about Mr. Emerson himself, since this is a privately held company. It very much has taken on the character of its owner. What makes him stand out?
Yeah, so, you know, he has been around for decades. He's 89 right now, and he's still really, really with it and driving himself to work every day in a silver Dodge pickup before 8 a.m. He's in the office 6 days a week. His son, you know, joked to me that, you know, He doesn't come in on Sundays anymore, but other than that, it's still the same old Red. I interviewed him and his two sons, Mark and George, who helped run the company in their boardroom in December. And it's one of their first interviews really ever. They're a very private family, and they don't open up the company to speaking and kind of showing what they're able to do that much.
And I understand they also have a bit of a reputation for frugality that really goes beyond what we usually see in the corporate world.
Oh, yes. It goes way beyond what is the norm here. One of my favorite little tidbits I learned was when they were first starting out, even as they were growing and they had planes, and Red would become kind of the airport traffic cop to decide, you know, who got to take which planes to check on which sawmills all across California. They would always keep these limos, quote unquote, at the airport. They were really just cars, but they kept these cars at the airports for employees to use whenever they were flying from one place or another. And these limos became famous because, you know, one had a mushroom growing in the back seat. Another one had a gaping hole in the floorboards. You know, that just shows how much employees and Red Emerson himself pride themselves on running a tight ship and being scrappy and not having to use more frivolous and extravagant amenities than, you know, some other kind of bigger companies might.
So certainly the logging industry has seen no shortage of criticism over the years from people in the environmental movement, but specifically with the post-fire logging operations that Sierra Pacific has really gotten heavily involved with, this company has also received some specific criticism there. Before we get into the critics, tell me a little more about what they do after a wildfire comes through a portion of the Sierra.
Yeah, so first thing to note is they have 8 sawmills in California. Those are actually sawmill sites. So they have 14 overall, and they're the biggest sawmill operator in California. And that's important because they have a position, and some of the laws limit who can bid on national forest logs, as I already had mentioned. And Sierra Pacific can then choose which projects they want to bid on or not. And, you know, they're the biggest winner of post-fire logging contracts. And so when a contract comes up, you know, they'll decide if they want to bid on it or not. But if they do, then they don't have their own loggers themselves. They use independent contractors. And then if they win a bid, and they can usually get most any bid that they want, they'll have a contractor come in, rip up the trees from the land, and then bring them back to their sawmills. But, you know, I mentioned the sawmills earlier, and that's important because, you know, even if they don't do the actual logging themselves, much of their annual volume in California comes from the secondary market. So a lot of their sawmills are placed well and close to national forests. So they have the advantage to also get logs that are cleared after a forest fire from independent loggers who might win another bid. And those independent loggers often don't have their own sawmills. So that's it's one of the ways that they've, you know, been able to really dominate.
So there are also critics of this practice, and specifically of this company's involvement in this practice. Tell me a little more about why this is controversial.
Right. So I think it's twofold. So first off, it's partially because the Forest Service is selling a lot of these logs for, you know, often 50 to 75% off the kind of normal market rate for a normal type of harvest. I saw one deal in 2017 that was 98%. Less than a normal harvest that same year. And, you know, Sierra Pacific says it's hard on machinery and it does turn planning on its head. So that does make up some of the difference, but we're still estimating they can make a very pretty penny off these deals. And that's important because a lot of the critics are saying that these riches have come at the expense of the environment. And more than 250 scientists recently signed a letter asking Congress to protect forests from post-fire logging because, for one, it strips land of nutrients and the trees can't regenerate once they've been cleared. But when they're not cleared, the forests are regenerating actually really quite well. I was, you know, walking through parts of where the Rim Fire burned, for example, and there are some conifers that are, you know, more than 5 feet tall. And the whole point of the Forest Service putting these bids out is that they say that, you know, the conifer regeneration doesn't really happen, but that's not exactly the case. The other part of this is that carbon stored in the charred tree trunks then don't get reabsorbed by the soil. So it also, you know, releases greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And, you know, amid climate change, which is only making wildfires more prevalent and more intense, that's not exactly where the trend should probably be going.
I understand that after your article was published, Emerson took issue with some of the reporting in the piece. He said the company is offended by the primary premise of the story, that they're benefiting from wildfire, and they disputed your claims about the profit they've made off of salvage logging. Tell me a little more about the process that went into your reporting on that.
Yeah, I think we never said that, you know, they wanted fires to happen. And I think that was never, you know, the point of the story. I think, you know, if so many people don't know that post-fire logging exists. And when I found out about it through the course of this reporting and spoke with the company, and, you know, when they were speaking with me about it, you know, they were proud of, you know, how they are able to go in after a fire and be aggressive. You know, I quote Red Emerson's son, for example, as, you know, saying we get in and we're very aggressive after a fire. And, you know, that's kind of what struck me at first. And that's why I started, you know, focusing on this, because it wasn't even, you know, originally the point of the story that I was going in and trying to look at.
So with Emerson now well into his elder years, what's the plan for this company moving forward?
Yeah. So Mark and George are, you know, kind of co-running the show here. Mark is the chairman and CFO, and George is the president. Red Emerson also has 13 grandsons, and four of which already work at the company. So, you know, I think this company will be around for a very long time. And, you know, they have a lot of land in California, and they harvest not so much of their own trees every year. So they're really kind of looking at this from a generational viewpoint. They want this company to be around, you know, for well beyond the current grandsons that are starting to be primed to take over.
We've been talking with journalist Chloe Sorvino. Her article in Forbes, $1 billion Fortune from Timber and Fire, profiles the company founded by Red Emerson, a Sierra Pacific Industries that dominates the logging industry in California. You can find it on Forbes.com. Chloe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Even if he didn't sell 72 million recordings, make 15 gold albums, and 5 number one hits, Herb Alpert would still be a music industry icon. For while he's best known as the trumpet player behind the instrumental pop sounds of the Tijuana Brass Group of the 1960s and 70s, his role as a record producer is also legendary. A co-founder of A&M Records, he went on to sign and record superstars from Sergio Mendes to The Carpenters, Cat Stevens, Peter Frampton, and Sting. Now 83, Alpert is still as active as ever, both as a musician, as a visual artist, and as a philanthropist, supporting music education programs at UCLA and CalArts. Now World Records in Bakersfield is bringing Alpert and his wife Lonnie Hall, former singer with Brazil 66, to the Central Valley for a concert Thursday, May 24th at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater. Herb joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Herb, welcome.
Hey, Joe. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So take us back to Los Angeles in the days you were growing up, before you founded the Tijuana Brass, before you became an influential record producer. What were the sounds that were around you in that day? What sort of led you on the path that eventually led you to stardom?
Well, it depends on what period you're talking about. You know, when I was 8 years old, I had this incredible experience at my grammar school in Los Angeles, where there was a music appreciation class, and there was a table filled with instruments, and I happened to pick up a trumpet, and the trumpet was talking for me, because I'm an introvert, basically, and as a kid, I was kind of a mute, so like when this horn was making this sound, it was talking for me, and that experience really obviously changed my life. It led me into a lot of different directions. So in the early days, you know, I was studying classical music, studying with some classical trumpet players, and then I got, you know, listening to Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis and some of the great jazz musicians, and I decided that's what I want to do. I want to close my eyes and just play whatever comes out. I just want to invent. And so that's what I've been pursuing. But the music that I was hearing when I was growing up was, you know, like, well, in the early days, it was Harry James, and then it was, Miles and Louis Armstrong. You know, I went through a period of trying to play like these people, only to realize that who wants to hear that? They've already done it. So I was in pursuit of finding my own voice on the trumpet, and that, came about in the early 60s.
And you certainly did that with the founding of the Tijuana Brass. How did that project develop? And did you have an idea of what you wanted to do and set out to accomplish that? Or was it more of something that evolved and then became this huge sensation?
Yeah, I think, luck plays such an important part in one's progression. I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana for about 3 years every spring. And there was I never listened to mariachi music, but there was a brass band in the stands. And they would introduce all the different events at the bullfight. You know, like, ba-da, ba-da-da, ba-da-da, ba-da, band, and the bull would charge out of the gates. And then, you know, they'd announce the matadors and the toreador, the picadors, blah, blah, blah. And it was exciting for me. And I tried to translate the feeling of those afternoons to a song. It was a song written by a friend of mine, and it turned into The Lonely Bull. And that was the first record we released on A&M Records. That was the start of A&M Records.
And did you have an idea that, wow, this has some ability to connect with the record-buying public? Did you have an inkling of where it was going to go?
I was hopeful that it would catch on, but you never know. I never tried to make hit records. I tried to make good records. I tried to make music that touched me, and I felt that if I can be touched by the music I make, maybe there'll be some other people that'll feel the same way.
You talk about the founding of A&M Records, hugely successful, and so many different artists and different genres. How did you go about learning the record business? Was that something? Hey, tell me about that.
Well, see, I'm a right brain guy. I'm 85% on the right side of my head because I paint, I sculpt, I make music, and I have a talent of surrounding myself with the right people, with people that can do things that I can't. And I was lucky to have a partner, Jerry Moss at A&M Records, he could shore up all those things I didn't have. And then, I had an amazing experience, positive and negative experience. I was recording for a major company before A&M Records, and I didn't like the way I was being treated. They were treating me not like an artist, but like a commodity. I was a number to them. When we were in the recording studio, I was 38257, take two. I didn't have a name. And so I filed all that, and when it came time for my chance with my own record company, I made the artist. The artist, it was, the A&M Records revolved around the artist. It was the artist first. It was a company that was very sensitive to the needs of an artist, and we felt if we would sign artists that were not necessarily the beat of the week, not necessarily the artists that were happening at the time, but artists that had something uniquely special to say, we would be successful, and that's what we did.
Yeah, what was the A&R approach there, A&R being the record industry term for developing talent and finding the right material and performers for a label? Just with the way the record industry has changed, it's hard to imagine where we are today, how it might have been back in the 60s when A&M was bringing everyone from Sergio Mendes to the Carpenters to the label. Was it hard to resist the financial pressures to go in one way and do, as you say, look the long game and try to get those artists who might not be the flavor of the month but might have a longer return?
Well, we were very fortunate, or I was very fortunate, because when the Tijuana Brass took off and we started selling millions of records and CDs, it gave us the freedom to be able to just pick and choose. We weren't desperate. And we were always after that artist that had unique talent. Like Cat Stevens, the police, carpenters you mentioned. We had, you know, Quincy Jones, Janet Jackson, Supertramp, Peter Frampton. We had, you know, a bevy of wonderful artists. And in 1966, I auditioned with my partner, Jerry, Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66, and we signed them to a long-term contract. And, you know, they were not the beat of the week, but I remember when I heard this music from Brazil, it was really intriguing. It was like a hybrid, you know, a little bit of Brazilian jazz, American jazz, classical music, African music. It had all these elements, and had no idea that the public was going to take to them, but we liked them, and that was good enough. So we felt if we could make good records, good, you know, give the public something that they might respond to, maybe the timing was right. But I, in answer to the question, I think timing is the whole game. You know, you got to be at the right place at the right time. If we tried to start A&M Records in today's environment, musical environment, it would have no chance, I don't think. We were very fortunate to be at the right place at the right time.
There's a lot of debates in society today about so-called cultural appropriation and whether it's off limits for artists to incorporate elements of other traditions or other cultures into their work and come up with something new. A lot of the material that your artists produced, it drew on different influences. You just talked about how Sergio Mendes combined all of these different ideas, your influence going to those bullfights and hearing the mariachi music in Tijuana leading to the Tijuana Brass. What do you think about that idea that's out there today about, you know, just given all the different influences that are out there? Is it a beneficial thing, or should people be striving for a certain purity in traditions that maybe are exclusive to one culture?
Ah, no, it really opens the door to something very beautiful. World music is, we borrow from, we did that with classical music. I mean, nobody has a hold on, you know, everyone is dealing in the Western lexicon. We're dealing with 12 notes, man. It's the same notes that Bach had, the same notes that Beethoven had, same notes that, Charlie Parker had, the same notes that Thelonious Monk had. You know, there's 12 notes, and you can scramble them up in lots of different ways and with lots of different rhythms and different, you know, permutations. And I think that's the fun of it all. We borrow, and it's a global society now. Everybody is pretty in tune with what's happening because of the Internet. So I think to be able to incorporate the different influences from different parts of the world is beautiful.
We're talking with Herb Alpert today on Valley Public Radio. He's performing with Lonnie Hall Thursday, May 24th at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater, presented by World Records. Speaking of how different cultures and different traditions incorporate things, how did you feel when you heard hip-hop artists start to sample your recordings?
Well, at first I wasn't so crazy about it because, you know, I like artists who have their own, you know, concept, their own ideas in terms of rhythms and grooves. And some of these artists, you know, had no musical experience, but they could take someone else's backdrop and put something on it. But, you know, as it kind of matured, I can understand why it's happening. And, you know, it's a cyclical event. Music changes from time to time. You never know what it's going to be like. For me, there was a little lack of melodies. It feels like on the radio you'd hear boom, 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 four to the floor. And there was like a little, it needed a little energy, how can I put it? Where's the meat? Where's the beef?
You've been very active in recent years through philanthropy and music education, especially with CalArts, with the UCLA School of Music, which bears your name, with Thelonious Monk Institute. Tell me a little more about how you're trying to give back and what you see as your legacy there.
Well, I think it's a really kind of a dangerous and fragile state we're in right now. We're the leadership of our country. They don't seem to have a clue about the importance of the arts in our society. The artists kind of define who we are. And boy, we can't lose that. That's what this country is all about. This country was formed by creative people, innovative people, and we need to make sure that these artists survive and are able to do what they have to do to identify us. So, you know, I had this opportunity when I was 8 years old, and I feel like all kids should be able to rub elbows with something creative at a real early age. It's a win-win situation because, you know, if they paint, sculpt, or play an instrument, poetry, acting, it doesn't really matter. As long as they can get some creative juices out and they start feeling good about themselves, they might be able to appreciate their own uniqueness. And then with fingers crossed, they might be able to appreciate the uniqueness in others. And I think we need a lot more of that.
You've had incredible success as both a performing artist and a record producer in the industry. You're at a point right now in your career where you don't need to tour, don't need to do concerts. Why do you to go out and you know perform on tour, go to places like Bakersfield? Tell me a little more about what you get out of being on stage at this point in your career.
It's not about I need to do it. I have to do it. I love to do it. I mean, it's something that's instilled in me, and I have this very fortunate career because I think, you know, luck plays an enormous part in the success of an artist. And I was at the right place at the right time. I sold a lot of records, as you mentioned, and I feel like there are a certain amount of people that would like to hear my music.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel great doing it. I practice every, you know, look at. You know, I do this every day because, you know, it's not something I have to do, but I do have to do it. You know, it's like, you know, Dizzy Gillespie was a friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say, he said, the closer I get, the farther it looks. and that's about the way it is with being a musician. You never get to that place where you say, I got this covered. This is a done deal. You know, now and then we probably all run across these geniuses who are just a whiz at what they do and what they've accomplished, and they probably don't think that same way. But, you know, most people that are just, you know, good musicians are always trying to get to that perfect place that you never arrive at.
We've been talking with Herb Alpert today. He is performing Thursday, May 24th in Bakersfield. Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater. World Records in Bakersfield presenting that show. And we're really excited to have you coming to the Central Valley. Herb, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been our pleasure.
Yeah, I hope to see people out there believe me, they will love our show. We've been playing for the last 12 years with the same group, standing ovations every night because it's an honest, authentic show that people will love.
Looking forward to it, Herb. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, man.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. You can find our comments page as well as our podcast and audio archives at kvpr.org. And all of those things available there on the website as well as our mobile app for smartphones and tablets. You can find the link on the App Store for iOS and Android devices. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Monica Velez and Carrie Klein, audio engineers Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.